Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and as we mark Mozart's 250th birthday today, Europe is a generally peaceful place. But in 1941, the 150th anniversary of Mozart's death was marked under much darker circumstances, namely World War II. And Mozart had become an unwitting icon for the Nazi propaganda machine. His works were used to promote Hitler's cause. Joining us to look at this seldom-told story is Eric Levy. He's a music journalist, broadcaster, and author of the book Music in the Third Reich. He joins us from London. He recently wrote about this topic for the BBC Music magazine. Eric Levy, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you.
It's pretty well known that Wagner seems to have been Hitler's composer of choice and that much of Wagner's music was appropriated by the Nazis. When and why did the campaign to appropriate Mozart get started?
Well, of course, it started pretty well in 1933 because, obviously, the Nazis coming to power in a democratic election wanted to appear to be seen as a respectable party to the middle classes. And in that way, they wanted to appear to be cultural lovers, and they wanted to appropriate all the great music of the past. And they started, of course, in 1933. It was a rather fortuitous year because you mentioned Wagner, but it was also the centenary of Brahms' birth, and that was an opportunity for the Nazis to cash in on a particular musical event. And in 1935, of course, there were anniversaries of the birth of Handel, Bach, and Heinrich Schütz, which the politicians got into. This idea of having festivals was a good one because it first of all gave musicians work because there was a lot of unemployment at the time, and it also kind of created a feeling of well-being amongst the German population.
Well, this is before the Anschluss, and Mozart.
Oh yes,
Mozart was of course Austrian, not German.
He was.
So. Were they already looking down that particular road, do you think?
Well, they were already thinking about the problem of performing Mozart because of his... there were two issues with Mozart that they needed to look at. One was the fact that Mozart was a Freemason and the Nazis were very opposed to Freemasonry. And, of course, Zauberflöte is a Masonic opera and they were trying very hard to suppress any element of Masonic connection in that opera. And then, of course... the other problem was that Mozart's greatest librettist was Lorenzo da Ponte, and he was Jewish. Nuremberg laws, that there was actually it was forbidden for an Aryan to work with a Jew, and so this meant there were sort of problems about performing Mozart's operas, particularly so in this case because the German translations in which they were most often performed were done by another Jew, Hermann Levy, who you may know in relation to Wagner. He conducted the first performance of Parsifal, but he also made these quite famous German translations, which were the standard way they were performed in German theatres.
So the Nazis really had a lot of twisting and turning to do to
absolutely, yeah,
to sort of repackage Mozart as a German symbol. So you mentioned Lorenzo da Ponte, a baptized Jew, but a Jew nonetheless. So that would seem to have ruled out Così fan tutte, Don Giovanni, and The Marriage of Figaro, the three great operas that the two of them collaborated on.
It would have, theoretically, but of course no opera house in Germany could not perform. I mean, you know, particularly Figaro and Don Giovanni were staple parts of the repertory, and the notion that they would be banned on such grounds would have caused kind of absurdity and perhaps a protest from the music fraternity. So obviously they couldn't go that far, but they tried as much as possible to take away the Jewish influence, and one way of doing that was to create new translations or to encourage writers to produce their own alternative translations to Lévy's and to suppress De Ponte's name totally, so that De Ponte was a non-person as far as they were concerned.
So not only did they need to suppress De Ponte's original libretto, they also wanted to suppress the original German translation because it too had been done, as you say, by a Jew.
Well, the one that was favoured at that time, there'd been earlier translations, but the ones that were generally in use, had the widest currency, were by Hermann Lévy. You can still buy them in translation if you go to Germany and look at a piano score of a Mozart opera. Breitkopf and Hertel published those ones, so they're still in currency.
What about the new translations that the Nazis specifically commissioned for their own purposes? Are those still circulating?
Well, surprisingly enough, it's quite a complicated story, and I'll try to sort of simplify it if I can. In the early 1930s, the translations that were most favoured were done by a career opportunist who jumped on the bandwagon and saw that this would be a way of, you know, making money and assuming a kind of worthy alternative, in inverted commas, to Lévy. And then this guy, whose name was Siegfried Anheiser, his work was performed in certain theatres, but other theatres refused to go along with it, and there was a bit of a battle from the Nazi authorities to try and persuade various theatres to actually to learn these new translations, because, of course, a lot of opera singers had learnt their German versions of Figaro and Don Giovanni in the Lévy translations. They were rather reluctant to go along with new translations. But then, of course, you mentioned the Anschluss, that kind of changed things completely, because, of course, Austria now became Germany, and it was at that moment, just before the war, that the Nazis established a kind of organization for arranging music, and they then provided funds for an official translation, which was done with the blessing of the propaganda ministry. Mm-hmm. And a lot of money was put forward for that, and in fact, it was done under the sort of guise of scholarly activity, because they were Urtext editions. But if you look at the original scores, which they're actually housed in the British Library, they have the frontispiece. There's no mention of De Ponte. And on the second page, it says in big letters that this score has been commissioned by the Dr. Goebbels. And, you know, it's an official sort of translation. And, in fact, the Nazis at that time produced a law which said that you couldn't perform Mozart except in this particular translation. And that translation is still current, actually. If you buy the Dover editions of the full score editions of the Mozart operas, which, of course, it's an American reprint, those are reprints of those 1940s editions. Amazing though it may seem.
That is amazing. Let me ask you, Eric, who were the Nazis aiming this? I mean, was this for the general public consumption? Was it a means, once things started going sour, to put on a happy face, as the song says?
I'm not quite sure what you mean by you mean in terms of the war, or
in terms of appropriating Mozart? Why bother? Who is this all for? Was it for?
Well, it was part of the ideology that they hammered home to everybody. You know, they couldn't have any kind of element of impurity in the great art. You know, it was a case. I mean, if you were thinking about performing, let's say, Schumann's Dichterliebe, which has poetry by Heinrich Heine, who's also Jewish, they had to sort of suppress the fact that Heine even existed. This was a way of making it palatable to the ideology of the time.
Okay, so it wasn't that it was meant to, I don't know, to sort of comfort the crowds, the general public, when, as I say, the war started to turn.
Ah, well, of course, then we're talking about a slightly different thing, that then to kind of make such a song and dance about Mozart became a kind of wartime propaganda thing, because Mozart's music was great, of course. It created a kind of balm in times of stress, but it was also used as a kind of nationalist symbol because this was what the German artists were capable of, and the politicians used Mozart as a weapon in their fight against the Soviet Union, against their enemies.
In fact, this recording that we're now hearing of Mozart's abduction from the Seraglio, this is a wartime recording made in September of 1944.
Of late.
By which time, yes, things had turned pretty sour indeed. But this is Elisabeth Schwarzkopf, great German singer, who seems to have been a fairly willing cooperator with the Nazis, although she downplayed it after the war. And this is an excerpt from Mozart's Abduction from the Seraglio. Well, in 1944, when the war had definitely turned against the Germans, I guess there was some comfort to be had in music like this from Mozart's Abduction from the Seraglio. Elisabeth Schwarzkopf with Rudolf Moralt conducting the Vienna Philharmonic in September of 1944. On Soundcheck, we are speaking with Eric Levy. He is author of the book Music in the Third Reich, and recently wrote about the attempted appropriation of Mozart's music by the Nazis in the BBC Music magazine. And, Eric, I suppose if I can go back to my very first question, we do know that that Wagner's music was appropriated with a great deal of success by the Nazis. Beethoven's music with far less success. And, you know, just from reading your article in the BBC Music magazine, it seems like the appropriation of Mozart was just a mess.
It was. They had to try and kind of cover up things, and they used subterfuge, really, and misleading information. I mean, Goebbels actually stood up at the 1941 festival in Vienna, marking Mozart's death, and said, you know, that of course the Masonic elements in Mozart's opera are not important. They have nothing to do with the opera itself. So he was deliberately misleading the public. That's a very good example.
Yeah, it's just, and it seems like somehow Mozart's reputation was never really tainted with this whiff of not. It seems like the people in outside of Germany, at least, after the war, you know, there was no problem playing Mozart's music in Israel, for example. You know, people, I think, just assumed that this was a crazy ploy on the Nazis' part.
It was. It was, indeed. But perhaps more interesting, of course, are some of the scholars who were working so hard to create this image of Mozart, of course, managed seamlessly to work on in post-war life as if nothing had happened. You mentioned the fact that Schwarzkopf downplayed her role in the Nazi era. I mean, these people simply kind of denied some of the articles and some of the statements that they'd made to support the regime.
Mm-hmm. Then there's the case of the great German conductor, Wilhelm Furtwängler, who actually refused to join the Nazi party, but, you know, was very much tainted by having stayed in Germany and you know, performed there during the Nazi regime. Do you know what his response to the various machinations of Mozart's music was?
Well, one interesting thing that I discovered when my research in Vienna was that in the 1940s, one of the most absurd things that the Nazis tried to impose on performers as far as Mozart was concerned was that they wanted, or they tried to order people to perform Mozart's Requiem, if they were going to perform a religious work, with a revised text in which all elements of the Old Testament were removed. So words like Sabbath and Zion were simply suppressed, a new Latin translation was used. Now, I noticed that in this 1941 festival, which ended with a performance of the Requiem, conducted by Fürth Wengler, I looked at the text and was quite pleased to note that the text was presented as Mozart had set it.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously there was some element of resistance to this kind of imposition, probably from Berlin. Because there was a famous recording, in fact, from 1941 in which this text is used without the Jewish words, or Old Testament words.
Right, but that was not a Fürth Wengler performance.
That was not a Fürth. It was his orchestra, the Berlin Philharmonic, but right. not him conducting. And it's interesting that when Fürth Wengler conducted the Requiem, he certainly didn't suppress, or he didn't bow to the pressure to perform it in this way. He probably would have thought it was absurd.
Well, let's actually hear a 1949, therefore post-war recording by Wilhelm Fürth Wengler here with the Vienna State Opera, and this is an excerpt from Act One of Mozart's The Magic Flute. An excerpt from Mozart's The Magic Flute, with Wilhelm Fürth Wengler leading the Vienna State Opera back in 1949. We're speaking with Eric Levy, who is author of the book Music in the Third Reich, and talking about the attempt by the Nazis to appropriate the music of Mozart. It's a seldom told story, and Eric, I guess part of the reason is that it really was not a smashing success on the Nazis' part.
Yeah, it's interesting that after 1941, a lot of mention of Mozart seems to disappear. There were hundreds of books, literally hundreds of books, published in 1941 in celebration of Mozart, the Mozart anniversary. There were concerts, there were broadcasts, there was a special broadcast, series of broadcasts which took place in all the occupied parts of Europe, because, of course, what they wanted to do was to trace Mozart's journey through his life and the various places that he visited. So, of course, they had a program from Paris, program from Milan. Of course, they were allies, and programs from the Czech Republic, where they, of course, the Germans occupied, and of course, Austria. The only place they couldn't get to, of course, was London. Mozart visited London when he was about six. I suppose had they been successful in the war, they would have, no doubt, broadcast a program from there as well.
Hmm. I guess it is, finally, kind of proof of Mozart's resilience, that that he was difficult to appropriate, and that, as we say, whatever kind of stain of Nazism was on his music seemed to come right off once the war ended.
Absolutely, yes. I agree with that.
Music in the Third Reich is the name of the book by my guest Eric Levy. He's a journalist and broadcaster who has joined us today from London as we mark Mozart's 250th birthday today. Eric, it is a fascinating little footnote to the story of Mozart and his music, and I thank you for sharing it with us this afternoon.
Great pleasure.
You're listening to Soundcheck. In a moment on Soundcheck, things get a little funky. Actually, they get very funky as Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings pile into the studio and join us for a live performance. Stay with us.